From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the man who describes himself as the instigator behind such comic talents as Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, and Chevy Chase. We meet director, writer, and sometimes actor Harold Ramis. He's not as visible as his cohorts, but he's been just as influential. He's just directed the new Bill Murray vehicle, Groundhog Day. Also, a talk about working women and childcare with Karen Nussbaum, co-founder of 9 to 5, the advocacy group for working women. And TV critic David Biancooley reviews the return of PBS's Prime Suspect, about a female chief inspector played by Helen Mirren. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
President Clinton introduced Florida prosecutor Janet Reno today as his nominee for attorney general. Reno, who's 54, is a graduate of Cornell University and Harvard Law School. During her 15 years as a prosecutor in Dade County, which includes Miami, Reno built a reputation for aggressively pursuing high-profile civil rights cases. She said today that she'll carry on that fight as head of the Justice Department.
I will work with all the administration to end racial, ethnic, and gender discrimination and disharmony in America by enforcing the laws to ensure equal opportunity for all Americans and by restoring civil rights enforcement as one of the top priorities of the department.
Reno is the president's second nominee for attorney general. His first nominee, corporate lawyer Zoe Baird, and a top candidate, Judge Kimba Wood, were eliminated earlier because of their use of illegal immigrants to care for their children. Following those setbacks, the president said he opened the process to review nominees of both sexes.
I also reviewed a large number of men for this position. And in the last several weeks, actually, I decided that I would just do it as if I were doing it all over again. I would go back to ground one. I reviewed a large number of potential candidates, both men and women.
The president said he had seriously considered at least four men for the job. In an unprecedented move, the International Atomic Energy Agency has demanded North Korea permit inspections of two suspected nuclear sites. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
North Korea has turned down requests by the International Atomic Energy Agency to visit two sites U.S. intelligence agencies believe may be linked to a clandestine nuclear weapons program. Now the IAEA has issued a demand for the first time in its history. Last year, North Korea finally allowed inspectors to check out its nuclear program, but when they began to verify the list of nuclear sites and materials, not everything added up, suggesting North Korea had produced more than the small amount of plutonium it acknowledged. This confrontation with North Korea is considered a test of the agency's new aggressiveness. If North Korea continues to refuse, the IAEA board is likely to turn the matter over to the UN Security Council. It could consider economic sanctions or other steps to force compliance. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street, partly in response to news that new claims for unemployment benefits dropped again in the final week of January. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 10 points to close at 3,422.6. Advances led declines by a margin of almost 3-2 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 253 million shares. This is NPR. An angry week-long public feud between General Motors and NBC appears to have come to an end. As NPR's Andy Bowers reports, GM now says it will not pull its advertising from the network's news programs.
The dispute flared up on Monday when GM accused NBC of airing a misleading segment on its Dateline program. The segment, about an alleged gas tank design flaw in some GM pickup trucks, showed one of those trucks exploding into flames after being hit from the side by another car. But GM was able to prove that NBC had rigged the pickup with explosive devices and a loose gas cap. NBC was forced to make a full on-air apology, and the two companies settled a lawsuit over the issue, but GM still refused to run its advertising on NBC news programs. Today, the auto giant reversed itself, saying it was satisfied with the network's apology. But NBC still appears to be deeply embarrassed by the incident. Its executives have undertaken what they called an urgent and intense review of why the truck was tampered with in the first place. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
The European Community's Trade Commissioner was in Washington today for talks with top officials from the Clinton administration. Sir Leon Britton came to give the EC's position on growing disputes with the U.S. over steel, EC government procurement practices, and subsidies to the European aircraft manufacturer Airbus. After the meeting, Commerce Secretary Ron Brown said that Britain had raised points about those issues that will be given careful consideration by the administration. Brown gave no details of any U.S. response. The Commerce Department has temporarily imposed stiff duties on many European steelmakers after charging them with dumping their products in the U.S. at less than fair market value. U.S. aircraft builders have threatened to file unfair trade charges against Airbus for allegedly selling its planes at unfairly low prices. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. If you look back at the comic films from the past 15 years, you'll see Harold Ramis' name attached to many of the classics. He co-wrote Animal House, Meatballs, Stripes, Ghostbusters, and Back to School. And he made his directorial debut with one of the smartest dumb films of the period, Caddyshack, and followed that up with National Lampoon's Vacation. In addition to writing, directing, and producing some of these films, Ramis also acted in Stripes and Ghostbusters. For his latest directing effort, Groundhog Day, Ramis has again teamed up with Bill Murray. Murray plays a self-centered TV newscaster sent to cover the annual Groundhog Day festivities in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. He's bored with the event since he's covered it so many times before. But he gets trapped in Punxsutawney by a blizzard, and when he wakes up the next morning, it's Groundhog Day all over again. And he's forced to relive the day over and over until he gets it right. Ramis didn't write the script, and he says when he first heard the idea, he wasn't interested. But once he read the script, he signed on to direct. I asked him what it was about the script that got him.
Well, you hear a lot of high-concept ideas for movies. So this was posed to me as this is a story of a guy reliving the same day over and over again. And I thought, well, that's interesting, and that'll probably work for about 20 minutes. When I read the script, I found that it went into all these unexpected areas, and it really was about one person's enlightenment, you know, at the risk of turning off people who are just looking for a good time at the movies. You know, it's about a guy who finally learns to step off the wheel of karma, as it were.
Were you looking for a movie that dealt with enlightenment?
Well, it's been my quest all my life.
Really? You didn't find it in Caddyshack?
Personally and professionally. Caddyshack was enlightening. It was enriching, let's put it that way, but not enlightening.
Now, do you have any advice for directors interested in directing Groundhogs? Do's and don'ts.
Well, the rule I always heard was the ABCs of directing: animals, boats, and children. Stay away from all of them.
Right.
And I've worked with boats, and I've worked with children, and they were both horrible. But the groundhog was sort of the best of all of them. He only bit Bill Murray, which was okay. And he only bit him twice, which was, you know, showed remarkable restraint on the groundhog's part, I thought. And Bill didn't bite him back, which was the big surprise.
Well, there's a scene with Bill Murray driving a car that he's stolen, and the groundhog is also at the wheel with him.
Yeah.
It looks like the groundhog is driving. Do they have sort of a natural grabbing instinct?
Yeah. Does this sound like a comedy about enlightenment?
Not yet.
Not yet, no. Yes, they have a natural grasping reflex. They kind of look like beavers without the flat tails. So I think they do probably pick up and dig things with these sort of well-articulated little paws they've got. So, yeah, they learned that when they put him on the steering wheel, he would actually cling to the wheel, and as long as they gave him something to chew on, he'd stay there.
How much improv is in Groundhog?
We do a lot of improvisation by choice. I think because Bill and I are both trained improvisationally at Second City, I think we treat the shooting of the film as really the last draft of the script. It's not just wild ad lib where we throw away the script and say, well, do something funny. It's really an outgrowth of all the work we've done preparing the script, and it's the last draft. It's just not written down.
You've said that you think your talents lie in making other people's comic ideas work, and you describe yourself as an instigator. Did you say that? And if you did, how far back do you think those talents go? I mean, do you think that's kind of your original talent that you've built on?
That's pretty fair. I've said it too many times. When someone asked me if I was the class clown, I said no, but I used to write for the class clown.
Right.
It's pretty accurate. I would sit there, terrified, afraid to do anything that would call attention to myself. I was a good student. I didn't want to get in trouble with my teachers. But I would sit next to the guy who was always in trouble, and I'd say, gee, it would be really funny if someone stood up and said this, wouldn't it? And he would be dumb enough to stand up and say it. So we'd get the laugh. You know, he'd get the laugh, and I'd give myself the credit for the laugh, and he'd get in trouble.
Well, reading about you, I found that the L.A. Times said you were the Clark Kent of comedy. Rodney Dangerfield said you were the Steven Spielberg of comedy. The Wall Street Journal said you were the Maxwell Perkins of comedy. Then I found another quote, I'm not sure who to attribute it to, where someone said that you were the Leon Trotsky of comedy.
I think I said that.
Oh, you said that. Which are you?
I might be one of the great second bananas of our generation. I don't know. I think I made up the Clark Kent one myself.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah. I like the Clark Kent one. I think part of the reason I write and don't perform so often is because I have these comedy alter egos inside that. So I look mild-mannered on the surface, and underneath there is a Bill Murray in there somewhere. There's a Rodney Dangerfield in there. There's a Chevy Chase longing to get out.
But it sounds like you're very happy to be the instigator, the guy behind the funny guy.
Yeah, it's kind of a relief in a way. When I look at what being the point man has done to some of my friends, you know, I think I can have a real life. Like I know Bill feels very much deprived of his real life by his success.
Are you also talking about Belushi?
I was thinking of John.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he was probably a victim of his success.
Do you feel that if you had been the front man and been a star like Belushi, that you could have gone his way too?
Easily, yeah, because I understood what was happening. It was one reason I've stayed away from an acting career is that it forces you into an obligatory narcissism about it. You have to worry. It's your job becomes worrying about how you look. How am I doing? How do I look? Do people like me? Am I good enough? And it becomes a constant series of rejections because naturally you're going to be rejected many more times than you're accepted as a performer, just in getting the work. So I don't think that's a healthy focus for people. It's probably better in the what we think of as the British system, where people are carefully trained as actors. It's a profession. They're able to separate their egos from the craft itself. We confuse their real lives with their performing selves.
Yeah. Now, you joined Chicago's Second City Improv Theater Troupe. This was back in 1969. Were you interested in the theater back then?
Oh, yeah. I was interested in entertainment in all its forms from the time I was about 4 years old. I parked myself in front of our first TV set and just didn't get up till I had to go to school.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I just watched everything, went to the movies at least one day on the weekend, sometimes twice, and those were the days of double features, even triple features with 25 cartoons. So I saw a lot of movies then and just gobbled up everything, you know.
Did you dream of being a certain actor? Or playing a certain part?
Oh, yeah. Well, at first, all the Errol Flynn roles, but also the Marx Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
I dreamed of being Harpo Marx. Mm-hmm. Someone reminded me today that Harpo Marx and I share a birthday.
Oh.
And he was like an idol to me when I was a little kid.
Did you like him just because he was so sweetly funny?
Yes, I thought he was wonderful. And the whole social orientation of the Marx Brothers, yeah, I thought was great. My father had several brothers, and I thought of my father and his brothers as the Marx Brothers. They had similar background, you know, Jewish immigrants and lower middle class. thumbing their noses at the upper crust. It just seemed like a kind of populist, radical comedy for its time, you know.
And it was. Was your father and were your uncles funny?
My father is very funny. Yeah, he very witty. He struck me as Groucho. So.
Now, when you joined, did you try out to join Second City, or did they invite you to try out? How did that work?
I had already taken workshops at Second City, which is a system that's been ongoing almost from the beginning of Second City. So I knew the technique, I knew the method. I'd been on stage a little, but the audition consisted of going in on a Saturday night after the regular company had done their show and actually improvising with them in front of a full house. That was the audition.
Wow.
Get up there and be funny.
And were you?
I guess it worked. He put me in the touring company, which was where I met Brian Murray, Bill's older brother, and Joe Flaherty, who I worked with many years after at Second City and on SCTV television show. So those were very valuable years to me.
Did you want to go on to Saturday Night Live like so many of your Second City alums did? I mean, were you invited?
There was a critical time. We had several of us had gone to work for the National Lampoon in New York, and I left that show to direct something for PBS with a very good old friend of mine, Michael Schamberg, who's now a film producer. He had a documentary company called TVTV, and they were doing the first alternate video, and PBS had started to buy it, and he wanted to do the first alternate entertainment series for PBS, and he asked me to direct it. So I left this Lampoon show we were doing in New York, and after I left, Lorne Michaels came in. It was the summer of 75, and cast John Belushi and Gilda in the original Saturday Night Company. He passed over Brian and Bill and Richard Belzer, who had replaced me in the Lampoon show. But we all knew each other. Everyone knew Chevy from Lemmings. Everyone knew Dan Aykroyd from the Canadian Second City. Then we started SCTV, and I couldn't imagine. I was head writer at SCTV. I couldn't imagine jumping, you know, our little show to do Saturday Night. It didn't seem like Saturday Night needed me. Lauren wasn't asking me to produce. He was act. He was just asking me to write. And at SCTV, I was getting to do anything I wanted to. So I felt a little left out. You know, that seemed like the ship had sailed somehow, and they had become a household word overnight almost. So I thought I missed the boat in a certain way. But
how about now?
No, I don't regret it one bit. I'd done enough sketch comedy. By the time SCTV was one season old, I was already working on the screenplay for Animal House, and once I knew I had a screenwriting career, I never really looked back and got wistful about TV.
Well, I want to talk some more, but we have to take a quick break. My guest is writer, director, actor Harold Ramis. His latest movie is called Groundhog Day. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Harold Ramis, and his latest movie is called Groundhog Day. Now, was National Lampoon's Animal House in any way autobiographical?
Oh, yeah. I worked with two great writers, Douglas Kenny and Chris Miller. And what we did was we basically were paid to sit in a room, and we thought we wrote down every funny thing we could remember from college. We just sat there and totally debriefed ourselves on college. We told every story we could remember, every character, and then we went into the every apocryphal story we'd ever heard, every anecdote, and we wrote it all down, and we had characters in mind, or characters started to evolve, and it just seemed to shape up very nicely once we had the plot. All these wonderful incidents fell into place.
Well, what were some of the wonderful incidents that happened to you that ended up in the movie?
Oh, God, What's the statute of limitations?
I don't know.
I can't even say.
No?
No. I mean, it all got amalgamated. I mean, we would start with one person's experience. And there's a sequence where they go to visit an outlying girls' college. They see a newspaper headline that, Tim Matheson's character, the otter, tries to phones a girl who he knows was recently deceased, and her roommate comes down to break the news to him, and he manipulates her into a date. It's a really sadistic and
that was you?
Twisted scene. Part of it was me. The Chris Miller actually contributed the dead co-ed to part of it.
Oh, geez.
The headline was "Sophomore Dies in Kiln Explosion."
Now, were you surprised that it became such a hit that it did?
No, we knew.
You knew you were onto something?
Oh, yeah, because no one had done it before. Doug Kenny had founded the National Lampoon along with Henry Beard and a guy named Rob Hoffman. And some of that Harvard arrogance was rubbing off on me at the time. I didn't go to Harvard. But, here they were, fresh from creating a small publishing empire. So we began to believe that we could have a big, big effect on the established media. And no one had done it in movies. No one had given a voice to our generation. No one had represented what those college years were like. I was in college from 62 to 66. And there was no good counterculture comedy. No comedy came out of the late 60s or the peace movement or civil rights. It just wasn't funny. But we knew that there was this tremendous well of comedy from the sort of pre-Kennedy assassination college years. 63, everything stopped.
Yeah.
When Kennedy died, the fun went out of American life for at least 10 years, and sort of till Watergate got fun again.
And then we got fun again.
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly been enough Animal House clones, and it seems like Animal House, at least in the movie world, has become another word for disgusting.
Yeah, which is, not fair.
Mm-hmm.
Because the odd thing is that people mistook the style for the content. You know, we didn't set out to do a disgusting movie. We set out to do a movie about our times, about a very important time, which had a point. I mean, it was countercultural, and that was what it was about. Everyone followed with movies that were just disgusting. So that's why I think the clones seem so thin for the most part.
You made your directorial debut with Caddyshack.
Very distinguished Caddyshack.
Bill Murray, Chevy Chase, Rodney Dangerfield. Although I have to tell you, I know so many people that say that this is their favorite movie, and these are people that have been, the head of ACLU in certain cities around the country.
Know. It's
this cult favorite. Was this an idea that you thought of?
No, Brian Murray and Doug Kenny. Brian had been a caddy. In fact, Bill and Brian had worked at the same country club in Wilmette, Illinois. Bill was a greenskeeper, and Brian was a caddy. And Doug had worked in a pro shop in a country club in Chagrin Falls, Ohio. He was more of a tennis player than a golfer. And I was the poor city kid who just, stood outside the fence looking in, wondering what that life was like. So it was a natural for this kind of what unfortunately became dubbed as the snobs versus slobs comedy, But it was about, for me it was a real, very derivative but very true to the old Marx Brothers spirit of, you take the underdogs and put them in this society setting and go after Margaret Dumont and Sig Ruman.
Now, did you write Rodney Dangerfield's lines at all, or did they come spontaneously?
We wrote some. I worked with Rodney. Rodney is not an improviser. Everything must be set, and very carefully set, every comma. It's almost a parody of the way he would work, but we would sit up at night, and he'd say, should I say and or should I say but?
Really?
And he'd try it with and he'd try it with but. And I'd say, but sounds good, Rodney. And no, I think I should say and. I said, okay, then say and. Maybe but is better. You think but is better? So we would do that endlessly. But he has such a tremendous backlog of great jokes. They're good. They're not just old jokes.
Yeah.
They're really good jokes.
Yeah.
So he would look through his old joke files for what might be appropriate to the script, and he'd say, you know, I used to do a joke in the 50s that might be appropriate here. And he would try it on me, and, you know, half the time they worked. I'd put them right in the script.
Do you think you'll always be doing comedy?
I have ideas for films that aren't comedies. I haven't yet tested myself to see if I can maintain my interest in them for the 2 years it takes to get a film made.
What kind of ideas, though?
Oh, I have I'd like to do a historical epic, believe it or not, about the antebellum South.
Hmm.
Why?
I asked.
I love reading history. I really do. I didn't when I was in school, but as an adult, I've discovered that that's where all the real stuff is, you know. And I'm so fascinated by some of the things that actually happened. I've been reading a book by Howard Zinn called A People's History of the United States. It's kind of a radical view of American history. And I read a story that occurred during the slavery period that just fascinated me. And I won't say what it is, but it would make a wonderful picture.
But is there some comfort in doing comedy, which, of course, you've done so much and so well?
It's not like comedy is the safe alternative.
Exactly.
Comedy is terrible. I mean, you know, you've heard people say it, you know, dying is easy, comedy is hard. Who said that? I don't remember. But it's true. You know, comedy is nightmarish, trying to make people laugh. You walk out on that limb, and it can be, talk about egg on your face. Mm.
But are you afraid that if you keep doing comedy that it will become formulaic, or, you know what I mean, that you won't be able to sustain the interest in it, or you'll fall back on your old jokes, your old habits?
Well, I think I reached the point where it probably was in danger of being formulaic. I mean, you know, Caddyshack 2 was probably a great alarm bell for me. Not that I was so directly involved in every stage of it, but, you know, I helped launch it and worked on it to some extent. And it was such an exercise because I'd done it. And it was, talk about deja vu, you know, it was we'd been there. And same with, to some extent, with the Ghostbusters sequel. I mean, we always asked ourselves, you know, why would we do it again? And then we ended up doing it again, and we thought we had a motivation. But the reality is, I think the challenge is to keep finding comedies that say new things, and then there's no danger of repeating what we've done before.
What are some of the current movies that you like that are coming out now?
Well, I just cast my nominating ballot for the Academy. I vote in the director's category.
That.
Yeah, I voted in the director's category, and everyone votes in the best picture category. So,
so what did you put up?
My five picks.
Your five picks. Go ahead.
Are Howard's End, Crying Game, Bad Lieutenant, Husbands and Wives, and The Player.
And The Player. Interesting.
There's, you know, I thought they were all unique in some way, and they all broke new ground. And I found them all vastly entertaining.
Harold Ramis, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been fun to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
Harold Ramis directed the new film Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray and Andy McDowell. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air. And this is the song that comes on the clock radio to wake up Bill Murray every morning as he relives Groundhog Day over and over and over.
Well, that's true, 'cause you got me, and baby, I got you. Hey, I got you, babe. I got you, babe.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wain with Fresh Air. In thousands of homes across America, parents have to grapple with the issue of child care. But it took the nominations of Zoe Baird and Kimba Wood for Attorney General to turn child care into a matter of media hype and public debate. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about how things have changed and not changed for women in the workforce with Karen Nussbaum, co-founder of 9 to 5, an advocacy group for working women. The group is 20 years old this year. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album Boats to Build by Guy Clark. You probably don't know him, but Ken thinks you should. And TV critic David Biancooley reviews Prime Suspect 2, the sequel to PBS's popular miniseries from last year, starring Helen Mirren as the chief inspector. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has nominated South Florida prosecutor Janet Reno to be U.S. Attorney General. She's Mr. Clinton's second nominee for the post after his first choice for the job was forced to withdraw because of controversy over hiring of illegal aliens. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
At age 54, Reno is single, has no children, and no nanny problems. She is highly regarded for her integrity and her hard work. Though she's viewed as a liberal Democrat, today she won the strong endorsement of a number of Republicans, including the president of the Florida State Senate and the counsel for the Republican State Party. Said GOP General Counsel Richard McFarlane, quote, "She's what a public servant ought to be. She manages to live on her salary and live in a modest and pleasant way that is very family-oriented. But if she had to put her best friend on trial for a violation of the law, they'd be prosecuted to the hilt," close quote. Reno's won a reputation as a tough prosecutor, but she's also been an outspoken proponent for crime prevention measures, particularly increased spending care for children and measures to decrease domestic violence. She's impaneled grand juries to investigate conditions in public housing and dropout rates in public schools, and she's aggressively prosecuted deadbeat fathers for failure to pay child support. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The FBI says that the hijacker of a German jetliner wants political asylum in the United States and action on the fighting in Bosnia. The lone hijacker of the plane with more than 100 people on board has been identified as a Somali national who took over the plane after boarding in Frankfurt this morning. The plane landed safely this afternoon at Kennedy Airport outside New York City. There were no injuries. A battalion of Swedish soldiers has arrived in Macedonia. Over the next few days, 700 soldiers are expected there as the main force of an experimental peacekeeping unit in the former Yugoslav Republic. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Skopje.
The Macedonian president requested troops last summer when there were fears that the fighting in Bosnia could spill over to Kosovo and then to Macedonia. The deployment today is part of something new in peacekeeping. The UN troops are assigned to monitor the border areas with Albania and with Kosovo, the part of Serbia with a majority of ethnic Albanians. According to the U.S. spokesman here, troops from Sweden, Finland, and Norway are a psychological presence. The idea is an early warning system to report on human rights violations and border provocations. For the past few months, monitors from CSCE countries, Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, have been also monitoring the border here. The UN troops are an experiment in preventative peacekeeping. In Skopje, this is Deborah Amos.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 10 points to close at 3,422.69 on volume of more than 253 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. In Moscow, Russian President Boris Yeltsin and his chief opponent in Parliament have agreed to meet in new efforts to settle a power struggle. These meetings come in advance of a scheduled vote in April over which branch of government should have the most power, Parliament or the President. Some regional officials have called on Yeltsin to cancel the vote, and he has proposed a commission to work out a compromise. Many of Yeltsin's reforms have been blocked by hardliners in Parliament who accuse him of gaining too much power. President Clinton told a group of business leaders today that they will be asked to sacrifice to reduce the federal deficit. Energy industry leaders fear that means some kind of fuel tax that will be imposed on producers. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
While the White House will not confirm whether an energy tax will be part of the final plan announced next week, administration officials say the options being considered have narrowed to an across-the-board sales tax on energy or a tax based on the energy content of a specific fuel. Several members of Congress who've been actively involved in energy issues over the years are lobbying for the sales tax option, or what's known as an ad valorem tax. But a BTU tax, which would tax fuels based on the measurement of energy, British thermal units, is also on the table. Both taxes are considered to be politically feasible because they don't single out producers or users of one specific fuel, nor do they hit one area of the country harder than the other. While the Clinton administration has not suggested what rate is being considered, a broad energy tax could be a sizable component of a deficit reduction plan and much easier to sell than a straight gas tax that hits consumers directly at the pump. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
The government says that retail sales last month moved up a slight 0.3%. Sales of durable goods were up more than 1%, but non-durables dropped 0.1%. Compared to January of last year, sales were up 6.6%. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Last January, the PBS series Mystery presented a miniseries called Prime Suspect. It was about a British detective who becomes a chief inspector just in time to lead an investigation into a high-profile murder case. What made the story so distinctive, in part, was that the inspector was a woman, played by Helen Mirren, who's known for her roles in the films The Cook, The Thief, His Wife and Her Lover, Excalibur, and The Comfort of Strangers. Mirren and Prime Suspect proved so popular both in England and America that a sequel miniseries was commissioned. Prime Suspect 2 begins tonight on PBS, and TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
The first Prime Suspect was the best miniseries of 1992, and Helen Mirren gave the year's best TV performance. Depending on the competition, she and Prime Suspect 2 may pull off the same trick for 93. It's the kind of mystery you rarely find on TV, or anywhere else, these days. The kind where characters matter as much as plot, and where the mystery itself just keeps getting deeper, stranger, and more surprising. The original Prime Suspect was mostly about office politics and sexual harassment, how Detective Jane Tennyson made her move to become chief inspector, and how her male and female co-workers related to her once she got the job. By the end of that miniseries, Tennyson had solved a tough case and gained the grudging respect, and even the loyalty, of the men and women in her department. So it makes sense that Helen Mirren looks like a different, more relaxed Jane Tennyson in Prime Suspect 2. Her hair is longer, her clothes are brighter, and she even wears a little makeup. But she's still as determined and persistent as ever, and her methods of interrogating suspects are just as shrewd. In this scene, she tries to pry information out of a reluctant witness by using a few provocative photographs.
That's your son, Eileen. Your son, the pornographer. Would you look at them, please? You won't look at them, all right? I'll describe them to you. The first shows a girl. She's about 14, I would say. Her face shows pain and fear. Right, this one shows a different girl. She's a little bit older, perhaps. Tell me where Jason is.
I don't know. We should never have come south. God, I did my best. He's no son of mine. He doesn't even talk like a son of mine. He's some sort of...
Tell me where Jason is.
While she's working on the case, Detective Tennyson is also working to advance and protect her own career. Sexual harassment also plays a part in this Prime Suspect sequel, but this time the major subtext isn't sexism, but racism. One of the new members of Tennyson's department is a black man, and his very presence sparks some friction, even from Tennyson. Not because she's prejudiced, but because she once slept with him at a police convention. That little secret not only complicates their professional relationship, but threatens to become public and impact both their careers. The murder mystery in Prime Suspect 2 isn't just a whodunit, it's also a whoisit. It starts with the discovery of a badly decomposed female, and they can't find the killer until they can identify the victim. Mirren once again gives a performance that's as good as it gets. As detectives in miniseries go, she's right up there with Michael Gambon in The Singing Detective and Alec Guinness in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. But there is one flaw in Prime Suspect 2. Certain lines of dialogue are overdubbed, badly and for no good reason. Hearing Tennyson in a particularly frustrated moment shouting baloney is just that. Prime Suspect 2 is the kind of mystery that will appeal only to mature viewers. So PBS, why not give us credit for a little maturity and let the obscenities stand?
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. This is Fresh Air. Child care is not just a family issue. It's now a hot political one. President Clinton's first two choices for attorney general were derailed because of child care. Working women with children have to live with this issue every day. Karen Nussbaum is the executive director of 9 to 5, a national organization of working women she co-founded 20 years ago. They've just issued their annual profile of working women. Based on the most recent data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau, it shows that women in the workplace have gained and lost in recent years.
Well, I think things have changed for working women. There are more of us in the workplace, which I think on the whole is good. You find more of us in management or professional jobs, and that's also a step forward. But in general, the problems are even more severe than they were 20 years ago. More women work because they absolutely have to. They're either the sole support of their families or their husbands earn less than $15,000 a year. Wages for women have been falling instead of growing with our higher-level jobs or increased skills. And we find that we are working more hours, and then that's combined with less pay. So the stress on working women and on families in general is just enormous.
You note that women's wages have declined since 1979. Is this true for men's wages as well?
Men's wages have also fallen, although it's not as uniformly true for all categories as it is for women. And this is it's startling in a way because this is the period during which women's jobs experienced an increase in skill level. So, for example, if you looked at clerical work, which is the largest job sector for women, one out of three women work as clerical workers, over the last 10 or 15 years, women in clerical jobs have been using far more complicated equipment, have had to learn how to use the machinery to do the jobs, but at the same time, their wages have been falling after you account for inflation.
And other jobs that you see where women's wages are falling as well?
Sure. You do find it in other job categories as well. It's not just the victimization of women, although we find that women are more vulnerable to the negative trends, but it's part of an overall development that's taking place for the American workforce, and that is the consequence of a business strategy that said the way we'll compete internationally is to put the squeeze on wages and to start eliminating benefits.
And the result of that, you're saying, is lowered wages for both men and women.
Yes. Yeah, so that we're finding that both men and women are having lower wages, and to the degree that there is a smaller wage gap between the wages of men and women, that's largely because men's wages have fallen, as we've seen the significant decline in higher-paid blue-collar factory jobs, and those men end up going into lower-paid service sector jobs.
Your report notes that one quarter of working women have low-paying jobs. You also note that two-thirds of all minimum wage workers are women.
Right. So that you've got most workers who are at minimum wage are women. Most part-time workers are women. Most heads of household who are in poverty are women. When you're looking at who is hurting the most, it is women wage earners and their families.
President Clinton recently signed the Family Leave Act. It applies to workers in companies of 50 or more employees, providing 12 weeks of unpaid leave for the birth of a baby or the adoption of a baby or a child or illness in the family. How do you think this will change the workforce? Or the workplace, rather.
Sure. I think the passage of the Family and Medical Leave Act is a tremendous victory, both for its substance, because it will actually improve the lives of some working parents, but also for its symbolic value. It is the first piece of legislation that says it is the rightful role of government to talk about work and family, to say that something has to change, that there's got to be some give on the part of businesses. And I think that that's as important a step as could have been taken.
Does it go far enough?
Oh, the bill itself doesn't go nearly far enough. No, it covers only half of all workers explicitly, and it doesn't solve the big problem of what do you do for income while you're on that leave, which is a problem particularly for low-income workers. But at least what it says is that this is a problem that will not go away, and it is not just the responsibility of parents, that if we expect adults to go to work every day, and we expect women as well as men to go to work every day, then someone has to take care of their families, that this can't just be the burden of on families themselves.
Well, let's talk about child care, since it's obviously been in the news so much. The report that you issued said that 70% of working women with children under six are working full-time. What kind of child care arrangements are working women finding for themselves?
Well, most women are turning to traditional child care arrangements. 40% of children are cared for by relatives, so you know, leave your kids with your mother, or your sister watches your kids when you go to work. Another approximately quarter of women or of children are cared for in family daycare, which means that the woman down the block watches four or five kids during the day, and that's who you leave them with. Another 25% or so are actually in daycare centers. And then a tiny fraction, 6%, are looked after in the home by a nanny or a housekeeper or a babysitter.
How much does child care eat up of a family's income?
Well, the less money you have, the more it costs you. So that if you're a low-income family, it's about 23% of your income. The average working family pays 10%, and those at the top are only 5%. But if you've got several kids in child care, even with a relatively high income, it can cost a lot. I had three kids in child care at one point, and I paid 25% of my income on child care. It's enormous. It's as much as you pay for rent or food or taxes.
Do you think there should be some kind of a national child care system, and do you think that would solve the problems of working Americans?
I think what we see is utter chaos. There is no child care system, and we must have a child care system. When the Zoe Baird and Kimball Wood cases arose, what we found was the window shade rising, and you saw that it's awful back there. It's terrible for the parents who are looking for child care, and it's terrible for the providers as well, so that we find that both parents and child care workers are finding the best of bad solutions. Parents look for low-cost providers. Providers try to get paid under the table so they don't have to pay Social Security because they can't afford that. We need a child care system. We need one that says that child care is valuable work and it will be paid at a higher rate. And then we also need a system that says parents will be able to afford this, which requires both higher pay for low-income parents, but also real investment on the part of both business and government.
Do you see the value in the status of women and children being linked? That somehow, as your report points out, many women are working at low-paying jobs and low-status jobs, and then you look at the condition of child care for the children of these women. Do you see that there's some connection there?
Sure. Actually, of course, it's women and children last in this society as opposed to women and children first. When most people in poverty in this country are children, what does that say about how much we care about children? Women are the people who are responsible for their children. Women aren't valued in the workplace, and their responsibilities at home are considered to be ones that they'll just take care of. these are enormous problems. They are, and that's why women, I think, are organizing. That's why they're demanding more changes. And that's why I think it's hopeful that now, for the first time, issues that concern working women are some of the flashpoint issues. Anita Hill tells the world that she's been sexually harassed, and that becomes a flashpoint. The issue over child care becomes a flashpoint in making appointments to the cabinet or high appointments in the government. Child care and family leave become important issues on the national agenda. There's beginning to be a resonance, a change of opinion about it, but I think unless women really organize and force the debate and push the policy solutions, then we won't get much further.
Karen Nussbaum, thank you very much for joining us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you, Marty.
Karen Nussbaum is the executive director of 9 to 5, a national organization of working women. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about the show today. Noah, President Clinton announced his new Attorney General, Janet Reno, from Miami. What can you tell us?
Nina Totenberg will have a rundown about that appointment, and I'll be talking with a local reporter in Miami, details about Janet Reno's long career there as the state attorney. The Bosnian ambassador to the United Nations says, in contrast to today's news stories, that the ethnic map of Bosnia is not set. There will be a chance, he says, to reopen negotiations about the way that map is drawn. Deborah Amos explains the Macedonian point of view with regard to peace in that region. And Robert Siegel has a welfare success story from Michigan.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The songs of singer-songwriter Guy Clark have been recorded by scores of artists, including Willie Nelson, Rodney Crowell, and Jerry Jeff Walker. Yet Clark's never achieved much commercial success for his own albums. Clark has a new collection called Boats to Build, and critic Ken Tucker says while the new album probably won't turn Clark into a superstar, it makes clear why Clark is respected by so many of his colleagues.
Sometimes I can't find my heart with both hands. You know, I usually got my head stuck down in the sand. I start to feel like I can't even breathe. Hey, what's that little breath of fresh air blowing up my sleeve? Must be my baby. Hey, hey, hey. She can make the Mississippi River run other way. Must be my baby. Just in time. How she always know when I'm about to lose my mind, yeah.
There are some reputations in popular music that are puzzling to anyone who's not a close friend or relative of the object of adoration. I've always felt this way about Guy Clark, who's held in high esteem by more singer-songwriters than you can shake a harmonica at. Clark is revered as an uncompromising artist who has combined folk, blues, and country music in idiosyncratic ways. As a tunesmith who's labored heroically to turn the perfect phrase in his austere yet romantic lyrics. I've been listening to Clark since his highly praised 1975 collection, Old Number One, and while I could appreciate his craft, what I heard chiefly was a low-key macho man in love with his own rough-hewn metaphors. He's a guy who has less in common with other musicians than with certain novelists, sensitive tough guys like Tom McGuane, James Salter, and Jim Harrison, who I've always also found stiff and forbidding. But on this latest album, Boats to Build, Guy Clark loosens up his legend just enough to let the rest of us in on why his most ardent fans like him so much.
Well, I'm gonna leave Texarkana, I'm going down to Louisiana, I'm gonna try my luck in Baton Rouge. I'm gonna follow old Red River down till I see the lights of town, man. I ain't gonna get no sleep in Baton Rouge. Sing Baton Rouge, Baton Rouge. I'm gonna get me some alligator shoes. Baton Rouge, Baton Rouge. I'm gonna wear them out down Baton Rouge.
Guy Clark comes from West Texas, and like other musical residents of that area, such as Townes Van Zandt and Jimmy Dale Gilmore, he's a bohemian cult artist. Hit singles and stardom will probably always elude him, but that's not what he's after anyway. He takes greater satisfaction pursuing his own vision and influencing colleagues he respects. The title song of this collection is most typical of the music Clark has made for more than two decades. Stately, carefully wrought, verging on being at once too fussy and too stoic for its own good. Yet this time around, Clark's umpteenth variation on the same sort of song sounds like a lovely classic.
Well, it's time for change. I'm tired of that same old saying, same old words, the same old lines, the same old tricks, and the same old rhymes. It's days, precious days, they roll in and out like waves. I got boards to bend, and I got planks to nail, I got charts to make, and I got seas to sail. I'm gonna build me a boat with these two hands. It'll be a fair curve from a noble plan. Let the chips fall.
The relative accessibility of this album is probably a fluke. Clark has never been a very productive artist, and his ripe world weariness is always in danger of curdling into melodramatic self-pity. All the more reason, therefore, to savor Boats to Build as the rare pleasure it is.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
After much work and made you backache, too much trouble to bring you heartbreak, too much gravy to make you fat, too much rain to run your hat, too much coffee to race your heart tick, too much road to make you homesick, too much money to make you lazy, too much whiskey to drive you crazy. Too much just ain't enough, too much ain't near enough. Breathing's got the only thing I do.
Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landrell. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, with Joan Tooley and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Chris McMahon. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Marty Moskowain.
Too much honky-tonk will kill you. Too much just ain't enough. Too much ain't near enough. Get you ticket. Too much dog will make you kick it. Too much hiding out will find you. Too much you know what will blind you. Too much wristwatch make you hurt.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the ban on gays and lesbians in the military. Many activists see this as a civil rights issue. We talk with one gay civil rights lawyer about discrimination and the law. I'm Marty Moskowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.